Welcome to From the Heart with me, Dawn Lister, and my guest today, Shantini. Welcome, Shantini.
Thank you, Dawn. It's a real honor to be here. I'm thrilled.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to talk to you. The name of this episode, I don't usually tell people the name of the episodes, but it feels apt to introduce it. I've called this one the Modern Yogini because I met you at my therapy center in Lyon-Cy, and we hadn't met before. You had just started coming along to join us as a therapist, and I'd hadn't met you, and so I didn't really know anything about you, and we just got chatting.
Yeah.
And we had an instant connection because we're both yogis, and I really got the sense that you live a yogic life. Or at least you try to.
Yeah, I think I like the try to.
and that conversation just felt really rich and almost fated. I mean, I don't really believe in fate, to be honest. I think we carve our own path in many ways, but it felt like something aligned and we were meant to have a conversation. And I remember saying to you, wait, we have to have this conversation on my podcast.
Yeah.
So there's lots of things I'm going to be uncovering today, which I'm really excited to hear about. One of the main ones being, you know, around the world of yoga as it is now. You know, it's something that has emerged from Southeast Asia, and we've co-opted it, and I think done it a lot of harm in many ways, but also perhaps in amongst that harm some good. And for me, yoga, meditation has to be something that is not about what happens on a mat. That's really almost feels irrelevant to me, what happens on the mat. It's such a teeny tiny part of my personal practice and what yoga means to me. And yet it has, in our Western culture, become something quite different. You know, it's all about what yoga can do for you physically and how it can make you look and what you look like and while you're doing it, and, you know, being seen to be somebody that is involved in the yoga world kind of has a whole subtext around it, which I'm not overly comfortable with. So I'm really curious to have that conversation. But firstly, I want to start by saying I'm dying to hear all about your early story as a young woman growing up in the, correct me if I get the pronunciation or anything wrong, in the Brahmin caste.
Yeah.
You were firstborn child, and from memory, your dad is quite a yogi.
My grandfather.
Grandfather.
Yeah.
Grandfather. So can you just set the scene for us?
Sure. So I was born to a very traditional, sort of strict Hindu family, and if for people who don't know, among the Hindus there's a huge caste system. It sort of defines who you are more than your religion, and you have the Brahmins who are like used to be the elitist or the caste right at the top, and then you had all the other different castes. But the way it sort of has panned out over the last two generations is you have the Brahmins, and then all the other castes have sort of formed together and as the non-Brahmins. And the Brahmins used to have the highest positions, were considered very intelligent, had all the jobs. But I think they kind of, I mean, I'm going back, let's say, two generations, they kind of didn't let anyone else rise up. So then there has been a movement to sort of even the playing field. And that has been a lot of anti-Brahmin things where, you know, they felt like, I mean, it's a very complex, complex sort of subject. But any application form for a school or a job, South India, I don't know about now, you have to put down your caste, not your religion, your caste.
Wow.
You cannot, your caste rules your life. If I wasn't born, forget the Hindu, in a Brahmin family, my whole life would have worked out different.
No. Is that still true today?
It is still true. You still have to, your caste is what determines That is a section in all application form where you put down your caste. It's a caste, not the religion.
Oh my gosh.
And if you're a Brahmin, it's like there is a bit of positive discrimination now, but that's rightfully so. So I couldn't get, you know, we're going off the subject, couldn't get into medical school because I was a Brahmin. So you had to get 97% to give the non-Brahmins and the scheduled caste a chance. So they can get 80% or 70%. So it's like a tiered system, which is right to sort of even the whole sort of, you know, way society was formed and not have them as the elitists, which I completely agree. In fact, I'm against the caste system totally. Going back to the original point, so I grew up in a very strict traditional family, and you just did as you were told, and you know, you sort of conformed. You had to be a good girl, and it is from. I had a very strong sense of devotion from a very young age, but I also strongly rebelled against certain sort of traditions and things. And, you know, I'm sure it's in other sort of strict culture. You can't ask why. You don't ask why. You just do. And because I didn't, you know, I had to stand up to a lot of powerful, forceful people. And that got me into trouble. But I would say that has been like the theme of my life. I had to fight for just having an opinion, for asking a question, for having a voice. But that was coming from somewhere very deep within, you know, this right for, you know, this right and wrong. I would say if one thing that has ruled me is the sense of right and wrong. So it was challenging because I chose to challenge in certain ways and I conformed in other ways.
My gosh. So growing up in the Brahmin caste, what was that like for you?
Oh, I pretended I wasn't one because they could tell by the way you spoke that you were a Brahmin. So we came away from very traditional Brahmin areas and we lived in a city called Coimbatore, which was a bit more not so. And one thing I would say for my parents is they didn't sort of stick to a Brahmin community.
Okay.
We came from a family of doctors, so they mingled more with the doctors rather than with the caste. So we didn't have so many Brahmin friends. We weren't forced to. We came out of that kind of, I don't know if we call it a culture or that kind of caste. You know, you sort of stay safe within your community. And we were much more, you know, integrated. So because of that, and I would never speak the way I would go. Maybe subconsciously, I didn't want to be one. So I would try not to talk like one. And but I mean, people would know if they sort of ask you your name, sometimes with your surname. So I sort of tried to blend in. And I longed, honestly, Dawn, my whole life I've longed to be belong to this other caste.
Oh, really?
And not be a Brahmin, which I thought was so much more cool.
Yeah, well, yes, I can imagine. My goodness, I literally can't get my head around that idea. I mean, in some ways, it kind of feels a little bit like the class system here, but worse.
It was much worse. I mean, you have to marry a Brahmin. I had to marry a Brahmin. There was no way out. There was someone I used to like, but, you know, this was something, like you see in the films, my mom, I mean, I would have literally been dragged down. I mean, even though it is, everybody was very, like I said, educated, refined, as long as you conformed, that was just not an option. My mom would go as far as to say, oh, I mean, over my dead body. And she meant it.
Yeah.
So you literally, it's not stuff made of movies. That was real life.
I actually have a friend who is married to someone who's Brahmin caste and she's not, and his family disowned them.
Oh yeah, I mean, I mean, hats off to him for going ahead and marrying who he likes. They cannot seem to get past that. The children, the happiness, they are so rooted and so stubborn, and then comes the clash with the god or how can you be like this and then call yourself, you know, and go and pray? What do you pray?
Yeah, that's exactly. So coming back to, you said you had this strong sense of devotion and you were brought up as Hindu. Can you speak a little bit more to that? You know, what do you mean by devotion and what do you, you know, what was being brought up as a Hindu? What did that mean to you then? What does it mean to you now?
So then every day there would be prayers. So you would get up in the morning, you have to have a shower. then you pray at the temple. It could be something simple. The lighting of the lamp is very, very important. It's done in the morning, and then sort of everyone has a shrine, a little room dedicated. It doesn't matter how big or small your house, you actually have a room. So you go in there and there's some, you do this kind of design on the floor. It's called a kolam. So it's done with a kind of pattern. And you have all these pictures of the gods, goddesses. You have, they have like fresh flowers. You mop, you sweep, you mop. So there's a little ritual around it. And then you pray. And on special occasions, I mean, which is a lot. I mean, every god has his own sort of, you know, special day, you know, sort of dedicated. And there would be, so it's a little bit more elaborate. And my father used to go to the temple when I was every single day before he went to work.
Wow.
Every morning. And we had this hibiscus flowers that would bloom in our house. And he would take this hibiscus flowers to this Ganesh temple. And the flowers which he gave would adorn this sort of main deity for years. And I mean, so it was just... That was just part of your life. And then you light the lamp in the evening before 6 p.m. It's like the lighting of the lamp signifies you, Lakshmi, or I mean, it's a goddess of wealth, not necessarily money, but wealth. You sort of welcome her. They say a house which is not lit, the goddess wouldn't want to visit.
Oh.
So it's a bit like the lighting the candle here. So the lamp is lit and then you sort of pray. And I mean, I would go and when I... It is so strange when I would do those things. I did it with such a deep and I don't know, like a connection or like an energy. It was like a very strong pull. But then I would leave this, I'll go off and I'll be quite happy to, you know, sneak off without my mother's knowledge, do all the things that you would normally do. But then there was this running sort of parallel with that.
Gosh, I can really feel that coming from you, that kind of real sense of connection. And I kind of want to use like the word call to God.
Yeah, yeah. And you would go to the temples, you would pray. I mean, it's that it's still, I mean, I don't go to the temples here and I'll come to that a bit later. You go to, I mean, I even church. I love going to church. I love going to, I mean, I've been to a mosque, any kind of place of worship. I feel like my body sort of reacts. Mm. And I start feeling sometimes like actual tingling. Mm. I feel I can relate to the most of the temples in India are very old, you know, hundreds of years to thousands. And then I just feel I can feel the time has stood by or something sort of passed. Excuse me. So I don't know. I just like the smell of the jasmine, the flowers, the camphor. You have the fire and the priest goes around. You know, all the smells that you associate with sandalwood and turmeric and, you know, the kumkum that they give you and all the noise. And I mean, it's not orderly if you've been to a temple. It's like chaos. And like sort of sounds and children running around and the temple bells going and, you know, everything is happening at the same time.
But I wonder, as I'm sort of, I'm having this real strong visual image of it happening in my mind. And on the one hand, it feels like I feel really exciting. And on the other hand, it makes me feel a little bit kind of, I really like a more, for me, I like something a bit more calm and peaceful.
Mm.
And that's my, probably what I need. My life can be quite chaotic. So wanting to go to a place of spiritual connection, I like it to be calmer. But I'm wondering if when you were going to these rituals, if that was kind of like your touchstone at the beginning and the end of each day that kind of set the tone for what was coming and sort of gave you a moment to pause. Is that what was going on for you, do you think?
So sorry, can you ask me that again? I think I've kind of lost.
It's okay. If you were thinking about back then when you went to temple,
yeah,
when you were younger, did that feel a bit like a touchstone of, in your day? Sort of, but you began the day with some sense of connection,
yeah,
some sense of, you know, being with God, being,
yeah,
some kind of energy, and then ending the day in that same way. It kind of almost acted like a container for you.
Yes, yes, I see what you're saying. I felt very sort of energized, or felt very connected, but it was very grounding as well. I felt it comforted me.
Okay.
It was a sense of comfort, and exactly like you say, a container. It kind of held me. And family life was complex. My mom was a militant, very, very strict. I mean, she ruled with fear. Yes. I mean, I remember even I got married, I came here even late into my 30s, and I'm living 10,000 miles away. One phone call from her, and I could feel the fear.
Really?
No, she really ruled with fear. I mean, there was affection, but this is how, you know, she took it very seriously. She's got three daughters, you know, she didn't know how far to go.
Right.
And I think she went sort of really too far.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh, that sounds challenging.
But loads of families, there was a fear. You knew when not to cross the line. You knew what you can do and can't do. Probably my mom was a bit more strict than others. But most, I'm talking about school, maybe. I mean, even teenage. I mean, even the most not so strict parents, you knew where you draw the line when it comes to certain things. You know, you can't go out and do, you know, you can go out with your girlfriends. You can't, you literally cannot speak to boys.
Gosh.
We grew up, went to all girls school, all girls university. If I'm seen speaking to a boy and someone told my parents, that's, I've done something bad. And I did speak to a lot of boys, so I was definitely a bad girl. I thought, to me, this feels normal. I'm not going to not do it. So I did clash with my mother a lot.
So interesting, these different cultural ways of bringing up your family. Just coming back to, you know, there's two things I want to pick up on here. And the first one, you know, this spirituality being very much a part of your family story. You know, I'm sure some of that's to do with where you grew up, because that's, you know, spirituality in my mind, correct me if I'm wrong, is still very much a part of Indian culture.
They're more religious, I would say. They're much, much more devoted. That is like a blind faith. Right. You know, there's still a lot of gurus and, you know, people would just go because they have this thing, oh, this will make everything better, that kind of a thing. So I think which can be misused by certain gurus and sannyasis. So I would say still it's much more religious. I'm not sure how, definitely there is spirituality, but I would say for majority of the people, it's more religious than spirituality. Okay. I mean, that I would say is forms like a certain cross-section who've crossed over to that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And there's a real delineation between spirituality and religion. I would say that I'm quite spiritual, but I'm not religious.
No.
You know, I don't like to be told how and when to do something, but I would say I have a very strong connection to that which could be called God. I have no idea what God really looks like or is. I think there's lots of different ways to go there. You know, I can find that experience of being with God on my mat, but also when I'm cooking, and also when I'm walking, and also when I'm with a client, or, you know, and, you know, you speak to prayer, you know, and devotion, you know, I will find that in chanting or reading a sacred text or some beautiful poetry. You know, there's lots of different ways of accessing spirituality. And I feel that part of the yoga world isn't particularly present. It almost feels like there's been an operation done on yoga and they've removed the spiritual bit.
It has definitely been hijacked, if that's okay to use. And I 100% agree with everything you said. I don't like being told when to pray, how to pray, what to pray. Maybe it's arrogance, but I think it's my personal relationship with God. It's just between me and him or her or this power. You know, no one needs to interfere or tell me what I should do. And coming back to this point about yoga, and when we started and you talked about yoga, it made my heart so, It's very rare. I think I can say a handful of people you meet and you just think, wow, that's how it should be. You just look into their eyes and you know. And you just think, this is what it's about. Because my practice has been, we're moving away from the spirituality to yoga, but that's, my practice has been a very personal one, just something which I've done in my own home for years, on and off, and you know, with the asanas, and then with the meditation or Raj Yoga. So it's, and the first time I actually went to a gym and went to a yoga studio, I was shocked. I was like, oh my God. I thought I'm curious, but I was quite terrified as well to go and think, what would I find? And this was only a few years ago. Until then, it has been such a private thing. I just do my thing. And then I was like, oh my goodness. This is nothing like what I imagined it to be.
And what was it that you discovered when you went into a yoga studio?
I think I probably didn't go to the right one. I mean, there was this lady and she talked about tequila yoga.
What? Tequila yoga? Tequila
yoga. God, I was so upset, Dawn.
Oh my God.
I thought this is something sacred and this is sacrilege. Apparently there is all kinds of yoga and people have gym yoga where they go out in a boat and have a drink. And I was thinking, why? I was actually talking to someone who is quite a young sort of man who's trained to become a yoga teacher. And he was like, oh, each one to their own. I said, no, each one not to their own. This is a very ancient Indian practice. You do not take this and do all this. And he says, why not? I said, because it's wrong. This is something, say, why don't you just do the yoga and then go and drink your tequila? Why do you have to combine the two? Yeah. Then I went to another yoga studio and I saw this lady, and you before you walked in, you removed your shoes. It's just the energy. It's just the respect for what that this is something quite sacred you're imparting. Yeah. And just the way they look at you, the way they welcome you. I mean, it's just this. And you walked in and it's like, wow, this is exactly how I thought it would be. So I'm very glad I got to experience that as well.
That is good to hear. And there are some wonderful, wonderful yoga teachers. I mean, I would say that I was very fortunate. One of my first experiences of yoga was with a Shivananda trained teacher who trained with the Shivananda school in India. And then the Shivananda ashrams in America, and then came over to the UK. So the practice felt very sacred. In fact, my first lot of classes, I did a few classes in a gym with this wonderful yoga teacher, and then she took me to the Hindu Bhavan Cultural Centre in West Kensington in London.
Oh yeah, my sister lives very close to that, the Bharati Vidya Bhavan. Yeah,
and
the Bhavan.
When we would do our practice in the basement, and I'd hear them singing upstairs, and our teacher, you know, he held a very sacred space. And I remember when there was quite a lot of us training to teach at that time, and he kept saying, none of you should be charging money. Give it to charity. And then we were all like, yeah, whatever. But as time has passed, I very quickly saw the wisdom in his words. And I do charge, I have to earn a living, but it's not what I do for money. It's not for a living.
No.
The way I earn my money is through my therapy work.
Yes.
And the yoga practice is just what I charge, just covers the cost of running the class. Because, you know, that it felt like stealing.
Yeah.
It felt like stealing from a culture that I was very much learning about, and probably in my lifetime will never fully understand, but was just trying to share as authentically as I could. And it just felt like, you can't take money for this work. It doesn't feel, you know, not like that, and not in that kind of very capitalist way. It goes against everything that we are really working towards as we practice. Just want to come back to, you said your grandfather was a yogi. I'm so curious. Can you tell us a little bit about
how
he influenced your family?
Yeah, he came from a very, it's a town now. It was a very small town. And we would go off for 6 weeks in the summer holidays, me and sometimes my younger sister. Not all three of us at the same time. And he was a doctor as well. I mean, looking back, he didn't speak much. He was a man of few words, but he would get up very early in the morning. And the house doesn't exist anymore. Still remember this old-fashioned sort of cupboard with the doors open, and you had all these little, everyone has loads of pictures and idols and, you know, in all different forms. And the one thing is, not many people would have a Shiva. People are scared. If you have a Shiva in your house, you need to do the Shiva Puja, which is a very elaborate puja. It's not to be taken lightly. And Shiva is, you know, is the most powerful. He's got the third eye and it destroys. So you kind of really, you know, it's like, oh my God, no, not Shiva. I wouldn't have a Shiva in the house. And but he would spend 3 hours, and I'm not joking, maybe two, definitely two, doing the Shiva Puja. So you sit there and you have the milk, and Abhishekam is when it's performed. Even now, and go to any temple, I don't know about here in India, they do an Abhishekam, which is like a ritual, a bath. But it's formed of so many different things. It starts with water, and then some sort of an essence, and then with the vibhuti. I mean, I don't know the English word, you know, that ash?
Yeah.
So it's has a bath with that, and then the kumkumam, and then honey, and then a fruit. So there's a real ritual to how the all temples all over India, they have this, you know, ritual for all the gods. And then the highlight is the pal abhishegam, which is milk. And then that milk is gathered and then is given to devotees. So the milk is poured onto the idol, and then it's like collected. And then everyone gets like a little spoonful. They come out, and so he would do the Shiva Puja with the lingam, and then you sort of light the camphor. I don't know if you've seen the traditional thing. And then he would go to work. He would come and he would do this sitting in Padmasana.
Wow. So for those of you who are listening who maybe don't understand some of the terminology, Padmasana is kind of that bound position where the legs
the lotus,
folded up, in that cross position, which I have to say I can't do. I've never been able to do. My hips don't like it. And very few people can do. But my God, for 2 hours? No.
He did.
Wow.
He did. I mean, I used to be able to do it for a bit. Now, I just sit just cross-legged. Don't do the Padmasana. And he would come back in the afternoon. Everything was like clockwork. He would have his lunch, he'd have a little rest, and he would again do this is not a prayer, there's something which Brahmins did, a kind of chanting or a like it was a chanting, maybe 40 minutes again in Padmasana, and then he would go off to work to his clinic. He would come back only walking, just come back, have his dinner. And I remember he'd ask my grandmother what she spent the money on. It was all written down, the accounts, and then he would go to bed. He did that for as long as he could, or as long as he lived.
So his whole life was around his devotion.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't think of it like that at the time, but now looking back over the years, I mean, that image, I mean, that's had such a, just watching it, and seeing him do it, and I look back and I think, wow. I mean, if that is not a yogi, yeah. I don't know who, you know, who is in today's, you know, in today's world.
Yeah. Which brings me to my question. The reason I called you the modern yogini, female yogi, is because I have a real, and I don't know what your feelings on this is, but I have a real feeling that our practice should inform our life. It should show up in how we interact with the people we encounter, our families, ourselves, our friends, our communities. And that if we are in a position where we have the capacity to, we should be, you know, supporting each other and partaking in acts of charity and acts of kindness. And, you know, and that should, I always use the expression with my students, I'll say, you are practicing so that you don't have to practice anymore. That you're practicing to learn how to purify internally, so your thoughts, to expand into love and compassion, to let go of, you know, some of you, I mean, I might not use this expression, but some of your karma perhaps.
Yes.
It's not something I particularly talk about so much in classes, more
Okay.
A bit setting, because it's not something that everybody understands or believes in. It can be quite triggering. No. Yeah. But that we take this knowledge and we it becomes part of our DNA. So as we breathe in and as we breathe out, that's what we're doing. And listening to some of the things that you do, I feel like that's really what you're embodying in your yeah. life. You know, you everything you do is an act of service.
Absolutely agree with everything you've said. My practice is nothing like my grandfather. I mean, it's not the discipline, but it's more how I interact with people. I love people and how I want to help. And like you say, sir, whether it's with, you know, and want to sort of do so much more. And it's about, like you say, that it's like taking that. And it's part of everything you do every day, rather than a very specified form of of worship, which I still have the greatest respect for. I still light the lamp in the morning and I still light the lamp. I mean, it's not the same as lighting a candle. To me, it still has to be the traditional lamp with the excuse me, with the wick. And we only use sesame oil because that's what we used to use in India. So I still do that, but it's incorporated much more in service and how you go about your everyday life. Yeah, absolutely.
What would you say that does for you, making your interactions in the world an act of service? What does that bring to you?
Even with my client, I think the more I give, the more I get. I'm constantly, I mean, I'm sure you get asked when you're working with sort of clients or this kind of work, do you ever feel drained? I said, yes, you do have difficult days and you do have tough situations. I never feel drained. I said, the more I give, I mean, it just fills up from somewhere. Mm-hmm. Because you're getting as you're giving. Mm-hmm. Really feel, and there is also a thing, you should not do something expecting a reward.
Yeah.
They say even acts of charity. So I'm not expecting, but it just happens.
Yeah.
It's, you just feel, I mean, you're getting every time you're giving.
That's so true. It's that as you, and I think it's that not expecting anything back is quite a big part of that, actually, because it's almost like the act of surrender, isn't it? I'm here with you. We're all together. I mean, I think we have to be careful to acknowledge that whilst we're all together, we're all on very different level playing fields.
And absolutely.
A much more comfortable and privileged place than many other people are. However, we can say, but I'm still here.
Yes.
And I want to serve you in whatever way I can.
Yeah. To me, it feels like unconditional love, not just for my children. And I've been reading so much for fellow human beings, for people, for women. You know, it's just sort of want to put your arms wide out and embrace everyone and just say, you know, it's going to be okay.
Yeah. That's so beautiful. It's so, so true. As we reflect on this kind of a personal practice that you've done, part of that is about charity. And one of the things I'd like you to speak about is one of the really incredible acts of charity that you and your family have taken part in. And so you have a social enterprise company. Can you tell us, A, what social enterprise means, and B, what it is, and how you work as a family together to do this?
Yeah, sure. So, the social enterprise is called Papi's Pickles. Papi is what my daughter used to be called when she was a baby. And Papi's Pickles was her baby. It was born about 10 years ago. We are social enterprise. Charity got a bit difficult to establish. So we thought social enterprise is anything that impacts on society. And again, I mean, you don't make a lot of profit in catering. Any profit is reinvested back. And Abhi is a founder. So me and my sister are the head chefs. So what was at the core of finding Papi's Pickles is we are Tamils from Tamil Nadu, South India. And I don't know if many people are aware or you're aware of the civil war that happened in Sri Lanka with the Tamils and the Sinhalites. I mean, this went on for about 40 years. Loads of Tamils fled, and I mean, they were called Tamil Tigers. I think people might relate more to Tamil Tigers, but they were freedom fighters. They were the minority, and they were That is a documentary called Killing Fields of Sri Lanka, and it was just a massacre. They were just wiped out. And there were protests, I think, in 2007 in front of the parliament. And this is like ongoing 40-year conflict. So there were Tamils who fled and managed to find refuge all over the world. And I think UK has a huge Tamil population. And we really wanted to do something for the Tamils, for the women, because they've fled here, come to a new country. And they're much more traditional than the Indian Tamils. They just stick within their community. They don't sort of venture out. I mean, they think the Indian Tamils are too forward. And we wanted to do something for them and combine our passion for food. I mean, I've cooked traditional South Indian food for the last 35 years I've lived here. I got married and came here in 86 to Yorkshire, and we would go and find. I mean, this is because of the person I was married to. It wasn't something I wanted to do. We would find fresh coconut, break open the coconut, scrape it out, and make the chutney.
Wow.
And everything was from scratch. And I used to be so annoyed, thinking, why did I have to be married to someone like this? Why am I forced to cook? I never wanted to cook. And I was forced to do it. It was a very forceful personality. So the children, and it's all vegetarian. We were vegetarian, and Brahmins are vegetarians. They don't eat even eggs. I mean, I don't know, they might even be vegan, but we would make homemade yogurt. And I was like thinking, this is a lot to do every single day. And then when this came about, I thought, oh my God, this is why I had to do all that. And everything we've cooked from old fashioned in Tamil Nadu is now so popular. I mean, it's all vegan, which just happens to be because it's all rice based. So I don't have to change anything. I don't have to tweak anything. So Papi's Pickles was born combining our passion for food and to support the Tamil women. So they've always been paid London living wage. We would and English speaking courses, food hygiene certificates, and we work as a team, like a real community. We speak the same language. Everybody washes up. Everybody does everything. There's no kind of hierarchy. And I mean, it has, it may be only like, you know, maybe 25, 30 women, but because there is no program, it's not like they come and they learn and then they leave. Some stay for a long time. I mean, most of them have found jobs in schools, which suits them. They have young children, single parents. I mean, they have come from difficult, traumatic. Everyone has lost someone in violent circumstances, a member of the family. So yeah, that's how Papi's Pickles came about, and really, really proud to have been part of it. It feels like very meaningful work, and also I think it's a privilege and honor to cook. There is a saying in Tamil, and when you serve someone and they eat what you have prepared, that is actually an honor. And it definitely cooked with love.
It just feels moving to hear you explain it. I mean, I kind of want to say, imagine if every company in the world had at its heart love.
Yeah.
Versus profit.
Yeah. I mean, the world would instantly be a better place.
It would be incredible. It wouldn't mean there would be no profit.
It just
that it would be is spent in a different way, and
the people
working within it would feel that love.
Yeah,
you know, I could feel the love that you speak of and the compassion, and I love that sense of there being no hierarchy. How incredible is that? Because I sometimes think when people come to this country, get pulled into some kind of community or program, there is a hierarchy.
It's,
we're here to look after you, a little pat on the head, aren't we good? And actually, they're human beings just like us who've had to probably overcome something we could never imagine.
No, can't imagine. Absolutely.
A huge amount.
If every time I go and meet one of these women, it's so humbling. I think I could have easily been you. You know, I could have had that. That could have happened to me. I'm just so, I've had my challenges, but I'm so lucky to be in this position to be able to do this. And Radhi has never took a salary. Abhi has never took a salary from Papi's Pickles. And when we got a grant, they said someone has to take a salary. So I have took a salary, not now, at a certain period, but exactly the same as all the women get paid, the same London living wage per hour that I worked.
That's amazing.
Nothing more.
That's called being a yogini.
I don't know.
where can we get some puppies pickles? I can testament that your cooking's amazing, but also that the pickles are amazing. We've had some at home and we thought they were incredible. Where can people buy them?
Just get in touch online, and we can post it. We quite often we send the pickles by post. We do all kinds of events, even as little as 10, 12. You know, lunches, dinners, breakfast, you name it, we've done it. We don't need a kitchen. We have served in offices where they have nothing.
Right. So you bring it.
We are very good at making something and delivering it. We just work to whatever someone wants.
So you say, when you see Pappy's Pickles, you get this idea that you only produce pickles. Actually, as well,
it is a bit misleading. That's right. Yeah. We produce specialized in South Indian and Sri Lankan food. From masala dosa to sambar, chutney, biryani, which is kothu roti, which is a famous Sri Lankan dish, to mutton rolls, to anything, you name it, we do it. I mean, the pickles, but by the time we had thought, it's a bit misleading. We were established, so it was a bit late to change, but we specialize in South Indian and Sri Lankan cuisine.
And you were featured in Waitrose magazine, is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, that just came out of the blue. They got in touch and in February, and it was like, oh, wow. In fact, they wanted to, we were going to collaborate them to do the pickles. I think quite a lot of companies wanted to, but it's fresh. There's no preservative. So we were caught in this. It has to be in the fresh food section and the cost implication. And, you know, so for various reasons, it hasn't gone into kind of mainstream. And if we add the preservative, it would change the taste. So, yeah, no, we were really pleased to be featured. And I was also a guest judge on an episode of MasterChef Professionals.
Wow, my gosh, that's incredible.
Yeah, no, that was a real, real, real privilege, again, actually, to go and experience something like that and to be part of that. And you just think, in this industry, you don't often get, you know, sort of to be invited to be wined and dined. So that was nice. That was really nice.
Yeah, I can imagine. And they were lucky to have you. Having tasted your cooking, I highly recommend you as a caterer for any and all occasions. It was incredible. What an incredible thing to be able to do, to be part of a charity that is feeding people. I mean, I as our listeners know, I'm a real, maybe devotee is too strong a word, but certainly a student of Ram Dass, and his guru was Neem Karoli Baba, who used to say, love everybody, tell the truth, feed everybody. I think that's you. Feed, that's very much your vibe. You know, you like to nurture and feed.
Yeah.
Full bellies. It's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing. You spoke, I want to just come back briefly to this idea of devotion. It's something that really is, as I'm aging, I'm not getting that old, I'm only 52, but as I'm getting into my late 40s and 50s, I've noticed a real call to a more devotional practice. I would say in earlier years, my practice was more karmic, and in that I like to do and be helpful. Whereas now I feel like my work's become much more internal, not that the helping has stopped anything, but that the relationship I want to develop with my spirituality has grown so much. It's become at the center of my practice. And part of that is, you know, listening to chanting prayer in the form of meditation practice. And, you know, I felt myself called to kind of like find a place that I can go to where I can be with people who kind of authentically on the same page with me. Can you speak a little bit about how your personal practice shows up for you in terms of, I know that you chant yourself. Could you speak a little bit to our listeners around why do you chant? What is a mantra? And what you know, maybe you could share a mantra with us.
Sure, yeah, of course. So we always sang slogans growing up with my grandmother. That's like Sanskrit sort of poems, even though we didn't learn Sanskrit. So we didn't know the meaning, but we would sing. So there was always singing to various gods, goddesses. You kind of grow up with that. And I think it was maybe 10, 12 years ago, maybe a bit longer. I was going through a very difficult time. And I found that, I couldn't even go to the temples here. I felt very judged. And I thought, where do I turn to? And that's when I discovered the mantra. So I found chanting as a more officially. Mm-hmm. I embraced it. It sort of really spoke to me. And a mantra is just like it's a sacred message or a text. And I think each mantra has a different meaning. It's, you know, dedicated to a god or a goddess and has so much, years of history behind it. And I've had so much conflict in my life. And I think in the last few years, I want to create this kind of around me something. I've become very sensitive to the energies and to the vibrations around me, and I want to create a space, and I want to create something which is positive and which is more embracing, and I'm kind of more tuned into that, let's say. And I think mantra, I just think is it's like a communication to the divine. That's how I see it. And if it's okay to just share this one passage from this book, which is actually called Healing Mantras. I mean, this goes back to right at the beginning where, you know, I think all religion, it talks about the word from God. It says, the Vedas speak of the divine sound, current Sabda Brahma, which permeates all and is the key to creation. In the Old Testament book of Exodus, the sound of trumpets is said to bring down the walls of Jericho. In the East, the trumpet sound is a great symbol of spiritual power. And the H.P., sorry, I haven't got glasses, Blavatsky, founder of the Theosophical Society, wrote in The Secret Doctrine, sound is a tremendous occult power. It is such a stupendous force that the electricity generated by a million Niagara could never counteract even the smallest potential when directed with proper knowledge.
Wow.
So the power, I mean, that's another book which is my Bible. So the power, I think, of the chant, and if you believe in it and the vibrations it creates, I think it just reaches, you know, anywhere. I mean, the universe.
I have. I really agree. I really agree with you. That's a beautiful. That's a beautiful passage. Thank you for sharing that. I recently had a little granddaughter. She's 6 months now.
Oh, congratulations!
Little Aurora Lily. We call her Rory because she likes Aurora. And from the moment she was born, I was very privileged to be at her birth. And from the moment she was born, I sang Ram to her. So she to well, the minute if she's a bit distressed or she's tired, I just sing rum rum rum, and she falls asleep. Is she her whatever she's doing, she'll instantly stop and look up. When we lock eyes, and when I sing rum to her, I sing from my heart, and I sing, and I call to God. So and then And she hears it, and sometimes if she's a bit stroppy, my daughter will ring me and say, can you sing Ram over the phone, Mum?
Oh, she's already a yogini. She's a yogini baby.
She's already a yogini. She brought a lot of challenges and a lot of wisdom, as all children do. So
yeah.
It's just the most, for me, that practice. And that's the chant I will sing at the end of my class. We say Om Shanti Peace and Ram at the end of each of my classes. And it's just that's kind of my way of, you know, inviting the students to remember, you know, that we're more than just what's happening to us, that there's something more, and that we're all connected in some way.
Yes, absolutely.
So I know you were going to very kindly share a chant with us. Could you maybe explain what that chant is, what it means to you, and why you've chosen that one?
Yeah, sure. So the one I am going to chant is Om Namah Shivaya. It's not a chant that I have. And also when I do the 40-day discipline of a mantra where you chant 108 times in the morning and 108 times at sunrise and sunset over 40 days, and you state an intention. My practice, I always find something happens. I've never chanted for myself or something around you, and then you just think, oh, I need to chant. So it's not conscious. I feel it sort of something from within, and then I go through, and then you find the right mantra. And then you chant. So I take it quite sort of seriously. And I wait for something to say, okay, now it's time to do this discipline. And this is why you're doing it. I have not been a devotee of Shiva, as I explained before. I mean, everyone's terrified of Shiva. But I had a few months ago, I had like a calling. And I had this vision of Shiva, and I was on my way to a retreat, and it was very powerful and it was very frightening. A whole night I didn't sleep, and I had this vision. He was just there in a human form, and I kept thinking, what do you want? What do you want from me? Just go away. And I was like, oh my God, I mean, what do you do? It was just a very, very hard to explain or make sense of it. And then the next day I was with a friend, and this was in the Lake District, and I said, I don't think I need to go to the retreat. I think this is what I've come for. And I said, I need to go. I need to get on a flight and go to Varanasi, which is where, you know, Kashi is like the Shiva, the holiest of Shiva temples. And maybe once upon a time, I would have thought I have to go. But, you know, now I'm a bit more sensible. And I thought, no, I need to go and complete the retreat. But it was so powerful. And all through the retreat, this image, and it kept coming, and and I spoke to one of the two ladies there who were exactly like you, delivered yoga in the way it should be, yogis, definite yoginis. And they said, you're just going through like a very intense sort of experience, let's say, as much as it was scary. And since then, I have, everywhere I go, I see Shiva now.
Gosh.
I went to a yoga factory in South End to do something, and I went upstairs and traditional photographs of Shiva, which you would not find. So there's something happening around Shiva. I haven't gone to Varanasi yet. I hope so soon.
I hope you get there.
So Om Namah Shivaya actually means I bow down. So Om is before the universe. There was a void of vibrations, and out of the vibration came the sound Om, and the universe was formed. Nama is I bow, and Shivaya is to Shiva, or it actually says it's to your inner self. So Shiva resides in all as our own consciousness. So, and it also tempers your ego and animosity and shows you to the right path. So that is the mantra.
Beautiful. I'm kind of curious, if that's what Shiva's role is, why is it so terrifying?
I don't know. It's just that you've grown up with Shiva being so powerful and the destroyer. He's the one who chopped his son's head off in anger, not realizing that's his son. And then Parvati came out and said, oh my God, that's our son. And then he had to quickly go and then find an elephant's head, and that's how Ganesha is formed. So he is, you know, it's someone you kind of, I don't know, just, it's probably not, but I brought up, you know, you grow up with this Shiva being this, and if he opens his third eye, the world would be destroyed. Oh my God, you know, it's that kind of a thing.
So it's kind of like a metaphor for the burning away of delusions, really.
Yeah, it is. It is.
It sounds like, you know, that we all come, especially as I can only speak as a woman, so maybe saying especially as women is not fair. As women, we come to a point in our life, in our 40s and 50s, where we do change quite significantly. Mm. And a lot of the stuff that felt very important when we were younger, still menstruating or in that kind of productive phase, whether that be having a family or creating some kind of business or a life and a community, you've done that bit and you're moving into a more reflective phase.
Yeah,
of course, why wouldn't Shiva come as a kind of a guide at this point and say,
yeah,
you've done that part of your life, now this is about you,
Exactly, that's right. This is more sort of to go within and to, you know, like to sort of find your inner self.
Yeah.
And I mean, and also, I mean, he's the powerful, but definitely Shiva and Parvati, you go back to the Vedic times, they form together. Mm-hmm. He is nothing without Parvati. So there was never like the male god is more powerful. It's very clear, it's the unity between them. The Shiva and the Parvati, they form two halves of a whole.
Oh, wow. Incredible. It's so interesting to hear these stories from a perspective.
Yeah.
Who's really grown up with it. I wonder if you could maybe recite the mantra for us maybe
sure.
a dozen times or so that we could kind of maybe, and maybe at home if you're listening to the mantra, if it's possible for you to do this and you're not walking or driving, please don't do this if you're walking or driving. You could just maybe close your eyes and take a moment just to really reflect on the words and the kind of the meaning behind them. Kind of let them hit home. Well, bless you. You've really got a dry throat, haven't you? You need some water or some nice.
No, I'm okay.
Or something.
Yeah.
Okay, so just maybe let's all take a moment and
okay.
Thank you. If you wouldn't mind sharing, that'd be great.
Okay. Namah Shiva. Namah Shiva. Namah Shiva.
Thank you. That was really beautiful. I think I might adopt that for a few weeks. Just it sang to me. Beautiful to hear it. Thank you so much for sharing that.
You're very welcome.
You spoke a little bit earlier, just mindful of our time. We're going to kind of close our conversation quite soon, but perhaps we can have you back. I feel like we've got more to talk about. As a modern yogini, what do you feel is like the message for you, you know, as a person that's, you know, mature in your practice and in your life? You've gone through, as you said, many challenging life experiences, and you're embodying a yogic lifestyle now. What's the message for you that you would like to share with, you know, our listeners and with the yoga and the meditation and spirituality community that might be listening?
I just think you've got to really ground yourself and be true to yourself. Like you say, it's so easy to get carried away with the practices and with, you know, and I have also found that people get a little insecure if you're within a group, or why so and so a bit more advanced in this sort of bit. I mean, we are all unique in our own way, and to and like you rightly said, to remember it is not about the external practices. It's about the internal, what's going on, and to connect with yourself. Acknowledge, I mean, who you are, and embrace that. You know, it doesn't matter how everybody else is, we are all unique. And to really, I think you need to be comfortable with that and accept. I think acceptance. And I think once you have done that, I mean, you'll flourish. I think so.
That's a really wise words. Thank you for that. As somebody who, you know, does have this spiritual practice, you said, you know, that you didn't attend the temples in the UK. You said that, you know, you felt, I think the word you used was rejected. Was that the right word, or judged?
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about that? What was that experience like for you?
Sure. I mean, I went through a divorce after 20 years of marriage, and I had lived in the UK for the whole time. We had, you know, three children, had a big community, used to go to the temple as a family. There's a temple in East Ham. And I think when, you know, when obviously it was quite a huge upheaval. And I think it sort of sent a lot of shockwaves around the community. And I mean, obviously no one supported me. And I mean, no one. I think that was the big turning point in my life. And also, strangely, I never lost faith. You know, it wasn't about that. It's about, it was nothing to do with, you know, the divine. This was more my battles with, you know, someone, and how do I get myself and my children out of this? So, you know, you don't kind of, this is nothing to do with I mean, just to, and all I would pray is for the strength to get me through this. Never ask, like, why me? You just think, I read somewhere and it says, why not?
Yeah.
Why not you? And I did find, when I went to the temple, the priest was a bit off. And that really, really upset me. I mean, those were the days when I needed to go to the temple. I needed that belonging. I mean, I don't now. I mean, we are going back about sort of 13 years. And it really, really upset my children. It's really put them off. Mm-hmm. The whole culture, the religion, the temple, when, you know, you're sort of judged, and I was made to feel quite uncomfortable. And this was someone I had, the priest, we had developed a relationship over a long time, and he was the head priest. So, I mean, I've made my peace with everyone and everything now. I have got, you know, I worked very hard, and I want to be, don't hold any anger, resentment, nothing towards anyone. I have let everything go, and, you know, each one is on their own journey, isn't it? And, you know, they have to acknowledge what they did, didn't do. So it's not for me to, but that was one of the reasons that, and I just thought, oh my God, at the end of the day, this is all, not him personally, but this is all you are. This is all this culture is. This is, and I mean, this is terrible. And when you just, everything you built just like crumbles down. But maybe as I'm talking to you, I think I had to go through that to become the person that I am.
Modern New Guinea. that's the thing. And this is where I have a slight, I think the word's dichotomy, but it might be the wrong word. And I apologize if it is. Is that I don't believe in co-opting a culture, and I don't believe that people who aren't from Southeast Asia shouldn't be teaching yoga practices. And I do believe there's no harm in things, you know, they have to be translatable for the modern world.
Mm.
Yeah. So here's a way in which that culture was not brought into the modern world and did you damage. Because
yes,
you were at a time where you were looking after your well-being and your children's well-being, you were abandoned because you fit in with an archaic culture that said you were meant to be stay married no matter what.
Very, very hypocritical.
And so I think, you know, whilst we don't want to lose the essence of a practice, and it's very important to acknowledge where it comes from and respect it and stay within the boundaries of what we understand, there is also something to be said. We are living in a modern world.
Yes.
And we have to make the practices meet us where we are.
Yes. Without losing its essence, which is what I think you're doing. You know, so, I mean, the religious practices I definitely have come away from. And I just think, well, I don't need them. But I just feel I'm strong enough in myself that I take what makes sense from all religion, all culture, you know, what feels right. At the end of the day, you have to do what feels right. And, you know, no culture is perfect, no religion is perfect. And you just draw on everything that works for you. And then you pass it on.
Yeah. It's about your inner experience.
Yeah.
And the divine can be felt in so many different ways. Yeah. And I think when we learn, you know, I grew up in a family, as the listeners will know, who are Jehovah's Witnesses, and it was really very much a cult and brought me to a place of feeling a lot of resistance and even disgust towards the idea of a God. And because God was somebody that had created a lot of pain and distress for me and in my family. And it took many, many years for me to come back to the idea of a divine that I could relate to. And, you know, things like saying a prayer before a meal felt almost, I couldn't do it. No, I wouldn't pray before a meal, but I sit for a moment with gratitude for the life that is in that food that I'm enjoying. These little moments, isn't there? These are all practices in themselves that bring you back in alignment to the world that we're living in so that we're not separate from it. For me, using our moment-to-moment experience to build stronger connections and love with the world that we're inhabiting, that's, you know, the food we eat, the environment we live in, how we choose to tread, you know, simple things like how much we drive, how often we fly, you know, where do we get our food from? All of those things are part of a wider practice, and our respect for, you know, Mother Earth should definitely, you know, be something we'd be considering. I would hope anyway.
Absolutely agree with you. It's, you know, it's sort of about the simple things. It doesn't have to be elaborate, doesn't have to be fancy. It's like those little moments, like you say, thankful for the food, thankful to have a roof over your head, thankful if you're able to pay your bills.
Yes, gosh, especially.
And, you know, we worship the sun, worship the moon, worship the earth, and, you know, really go back to the basics.
Yeah.
I think there's a real beauty in that.
Yeah. Shantini, I hope your cough clears up.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been wonderful. Thank you for all that you bring to the world. Whether it be through your work as a therapist, a friend and mother, sister, daughter, holding space, your work in social enterprise, and the time that you've so kindly given to us. I hope you'll come back. There's more to talk about.
Thank you so much. It has been absolutely extraordinary. And I can really, really feel your love and your compassion and what you do, and even to make the time to do these podcasts, you know, really, really acknowledge that. And thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you. And thank you to our listeners. Please do leave a little review somewhere in the podcasty world where you can leave reviews. It helps push the old podcast up the ranks so that more people get to hear the wonderful conversations that we're so lucky to have. If you have something that you'd like to hear Shantini come back and chat to us about, then stick it in the comments and we can certainly invite her back for more conversation around being a modern yogini. I wish you all well. I wish you happiness, health, and the gift of always knowing friendship. Have a wonderful day, everybody. Thank you for listening.